hello again. This is Rahasia, Rahasia Uncensored on the Spiritual Activist Show, and coming to you through the BBS radio show out of California on the World Wide Web. So guess what? Today we're going to be talking to Sasha. I interviewed Sasha a while back at the UFO convention, and he has something pretty interesting to say, because this is something I've been keeping up with, and I have to use some discernment when it comes to things like Nibiru, Planet X, the Sumerian tablets and all this. But I tell you, as the evidence mounts up, you're forced into a position where you have to at least ask the question, could this be? Now, we have all kinds of pictures. There does seem like there's something out there coming in from us at the Antarctic. And this would explain a lot of the interactions going on down there, with heads of state going there, religious leaders, the president, all of it low-key and not really a lot of it in the press. And there's so much other things going on too, like the deep underground military bases, nicknamed Dumb. If you look that up on YouTube, you'll see that there's a lot of activity going on under the ground. Why they're underground, where are these tunnels going to? Your guess is as good as mine, but the evidence is mounting that they're connecting underground military bases with high-speed tunnel systems. They opened up a place in Washington, D.C. called the Crystal City. Look it up. This is something that everybody can go into now. It's Starbucks and place where you can go shopping and catch interconnecting subway systems. But as you're listening to Sasha, Sasha is a student of Zachariah Sitchin, and he's done his homework, and he tells an interesting story. So listen to it, and then we'll talk after the interview and see what we come up with here. So here's Sasha at the UFO Congress in Arizona. Okay, here we are today at the UFO Congress in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I'm talking to Sasha. Sasha, tell me about yourself.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sasha Lesson. I'm a student of Zachariah Sitchin, who gave us the information in great detail about the Anunnaki, who 450,000 years ago, they came to Earth to get gold, which they wanted to change into white powder of monoatomic gold that flowed into their atmosphere to protect it as goes through its huge orbit of 3,600 years around Nemesis, the Pear star. It's a subdwarf, and then comes around Solaris and passes through the inner solar system between Mars.
This
and Jupiter.
Is Nibiru.
This is Nibiru, and they came to Earth. They their miners mutinied about 300,000 years ago. And their chief geneticist said, look, we'll let our miners go and I'll adapt our genome to Earth using some genes from Homo erectus. Homo erectus was an intelligent hominoid species, the ancestor of modern Sasquatch, that was here. And so they made mine slaves, and they kept breeding with the prettiest girls in each generation. And basically, they settled the whole world. They had a thermonuclear war among their factions, and the war, first of all, they bombed Sodom and Gomorrah. The Bible has it as though they're sinning cities, but the sin was they went against Enlil, Yahweh, and sided with Prince Marduk, and that's what that was really about. But anyway, they bombed Canaan, which had gone over to Marduk.
And I hear there's a lot of evidence that actually validates that.
Absolutely.
They have the green glass.
That's called Tephra. In the Sinai's where they had their big runway on the Sinai Peninsula. And so they bombed the Sinai Peninsula. They bombed the south end of the Salt Sea, which became the Dead Sea. It's dead to this day. But the fallout blew over Iraq, Sumer, where they're, except it spared Babylon, which is Iraq, which is way far to the north. And so Prince Marduk got charge of Earth. And then later on, when Nannar, his other name is Sin, Sinai was named after him, became the king of Nibiru, he came back and had his men, he's Allah. And so these two Anunnaki factions have infiltrated the Illuminati and the people that are running Earth and basically keeping us fighting against each other, so we never realize there's only a few hundred of them and there's millions of us. And so, but recently, the Anunnaki have had a change of rulership, and Galzu from the Federation, the higher ups, have basically said, knock it off. These people are going to extinguish themselves unless you actively rescue them. So Enki has been sent back, their chief scientist, and Marduk, who has been, and Nana, whose people have been assassinating each other, have had a truce, and they say, and Marduk says he is contrite and wishes to make amends. And the Anunnaki are here. When Thoth, named Ishida, left Earth in 311 BCE, he said, I'm going to return December 21st, 2012, and I'm going to bring some 20 of my colleagues with us, and we're going to clean up this mess as much as we can. And there's been a number of meetings with the Anunnaki and the other skyfaring people that are concerned with Earth, with the Linkage Institute, which I'm associated.
So do you think they're going to come back in their lifetime?
They are here. They're here.
I mean, actually, overtly show up.
They are here. They are overtly showing up. Michael Lee Hill is the embodiment in modern times of Enki. They have haploid group. The Americans that are part of this code array are in the Lake Erie area. They intermarried with the Iroquois, the Northern Iroquois, and we got the League of the Haudenosaunee.
It's strange too, because the Iroquois, the Sioux, a lot of the Indian names have a reptilian snake ancestry.
Absolutely.
Attached to it.
And so this is the clan. Enki symbol is the snake, which is a symbol of the, our DNA because they're geneticists.
So is all this in your book?
It's all in my books. Yeah. Anunnaki, False Guide.
What's your website?
My website is Enki Speaks, and we have extensive pictures and evidence. This book is divided into the story and the evidence, and there's a chronology. This summarizes all of Zachariah Sitchin's works and takes it a lot further too, because while most of the Anunnaki left after this fallout ruined Sumer, not all of them left. Some of them stayed, and they continued to influence events on Earth. And a lot of it focuses around Jerusalem, which is where they had the mission control for the Sinai spaceport. When that was bombed out, most of the Anunnaki went to their spaceport at Tiwanaku, took off from Nazca, brought as much gold back as they can. On the wall at Pumapuka, where you leave Tiwanaku and move toward the runway, there's friezes of all the different spacefaring races that pass through Tiwanaku. And so there's grays, there's coneheads, there's pearheads,
and there's many different races.
So the Anunnaki did not really go into some of their battles with some of the other races that have been underground. There's a huge underground. Of course, the Nazis knew about it and had allied with the reptilians. And for many years, they've been taking promising humans, and they have a whole inner Earth that you can enter.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Cool.
Absolutely. And another thing we want to talk about, Sasha, is a lot of people are concerned about Nibiru. There's a lot of, the Vatican, the Swiss people, the Americans, we're all putting these infrared telescopes at the Antarctic.
Yeah.
And they're pointing them for a reason, because that's where Nibiru is supposedly coming in, Planet X, whatever you want to call it. What do you have to say about
that? Well, it's way more than people are talking. We have actual photos from SOHO that before NASA gets hold of them, from all over the world. My colleague Robert Evans has been posting these pictures. It looks like two suns. Nibiru is definitely within eyesight. There's nothing to be alarmed about. It's just going to be a fantastic visual display. The Linkage Institute and other skyfaring people have created a situation to protect us. If you look in the area of Solaris, our sun, you'll see with even binoculars, you'll see that there are, and especially with cameras, you'll see that there are motherships, something that we would call a mothership, a band of lights, and you'll see a flare coming from the sun, and it looks like something coming in, and something shoots out from this thing I'm calling a mothership, and it's gone. Some people have said this is those ships getting their energy from the sun. Other people are saying that no, some of them, they've been zapping detritus that comes in. And see, it's not just Nibiru that and its satellites that come through, but there's all kinds of comets and asteroid bits and stuff that comes through too. And some of the really terrible things that have happened on Earth, like the Moses' flood, which was a part of this eruption of a Stromboli and caused the sinking of the Minoan fleet. This is all due to something called the Lagrange points of Nibiru. Andy Lloyd, an astronomer, says that right now we may not even be seeing Nibiru. I think it's Nibiru. He says what we might be seeing is 190 degrees from Nibiru. There's stuff, bits left over for where Nibiru struck into Tiamat, the proto-Earth, and knocked out the asteroid belt. And some of this stuff always stays as far from Nibiru as possible. It's called a Lagrange point. So as Nibiru moves around its orbit, this stuff moves around too. And so that Moses' flood that I just described of Egypt came probably from asteroids or a huge comet that were associated with the Lagrange points. There's also detritus in the Lagrange points of 90 degrees on the orbit too. So, but right now it is Nibiru, and Nibiru is here. A.R. Borden and the Linkage Institute have published stuff about how they were able to bend time space and get us past any danger that we, so that we would be on the other side of the sun when Nibiru passed through in a way that would cause gravitational disturbances, so that the fears of a reversal of the sudden reversal of the poles seems to me to be a fearful projection and not real. But my advice is, we don't, let's imagine that the coming of Nibiru might mean disaster and we'll all get killed, or it might not. I think it's better to assume that it might not and have a good time while you're here, and then if you're dead, it won't matter anyway, and if you're alive, it won't matter either. So have a good time.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, I'll admit that is quite a story, and it's quite an alternative history. But is it any more alternative than the Garden of Eden story with the snake and all of the other things that we've been taught all of our lives, and we just assume that it's correct because it's always been taught that way? There's an alternative human history story that's happening. And I think if you think back a few weeks ago, I interviewed Michael Cremo, and he talks about this too. It's human devolution. It's an alternative story, and it's coming out slowly but surely, but it's picking up speed, that we do have an alternative history in our human past, and it has a lot to do with extraterrestrials and their intervention into our bloodline. And this is becoming more and more into the forefront. I know there's many, many, many books out there because I review a lot of books for our magazine. And when I was writing my book, To Believe or Not to Believe, The Social and Neurological Consequences of Belief Systems, it was obvious that there's social and neurological consequences to belief systems. But what got me really interested in what Sasha was talking about is when I started doing background research for the book, figuring out where did these writings come from? Where did the early Hebrew writings come from that the Bible is taken from? Where is some of the Vedic literature coming from? Where is some of the Quran, everything, all of these religious books that we hold so dear and sacred, where did they come from? What are they based on? Well, come to find out, most of them are based upon Sumerian tablets that are old writings from about 3000 BC, and it has to do with a Sumerian culture that just appeared, and things like the Epic of Creation, the epic of creation is a more involved and complete story than the Genesis story. The Genesis story we read in the Bible is an edited down story that was more like for if you wanted to tell your kids a story. And the Epic of Gilgamesh, that's the Noah story, but far more detail, where they go in and they tell you exactly how they got here, what they did to us, and why. Now, you're stuck with a couple of conclusions here. Either they were trying to play some kind of a weird joke on us that people thousands of years later would wonder about, or they were actually writing what happened. And if you look into the cultures of anybody on this planet, Native Americans, indigenous people, the Mayan, the Aztecs, the Egyptians, they all talk about the same thing. The ancient Indian culture, they say that their culture came about in those old days from people, beings that came down out of the sky, taught them how to build irrigation systems, how to do farming, how to set up civilizations. And it's the same story all over the planet. And it is just a little different according to culture, society, environment, but the basic premise is always the same. They came down from out of the sky, landed on this planet, and taught us basically how to build a civilization. Now here we are today. Now we have to ask the question, did they do this and just take off? Or are they still here? What is it about the underground installations that has our government and most of the nations in this world so concerned about that they're digging down deeper and deeper and tunneling? And you have to look this up. Don't take my word for anything that I'm telling you right now. Do your research, because I could tell you everything there is to know about this, and it wouldn't mean anything until you actually validate it yourself. So go out there and do some research and realize that our human history is interesting, is not really what quite the word I want to use. It's an adventurous episode in the galactic adventure that we've been having throughout time. So now we're going to listen to somebody else. And Dr. Jacobs has another take on extraterrestrials and especially abductions. So when we listen to him, we're going to have to think about something here, because he was very clear to me that when he started looking into this with some of the old timers, J. Allen Hynek and Dr. Mack from the Harvard, these people were looking into it and trying to disprove what they were researching. But little by little, the evidence became overwhelming. And now Dr. Jacobs, he says it's not really a fun thing to do anymore, because the more he's looked into this, the more he's starting to realize that something very serious is happening on this planet. So let's listen to Dr. Jacobs now, and we'll talk a little bit later.
My name is David Jacobs. I'm a retired professor of U.S. history from Temple University in Philadelphia. I have been interested in the UFO and abduction phenomenon for over 50 years. And I have, since 1982, I've concentrated on people who say that they've been abducted on board UFOs. Now, the UFO phenomenon is a global phenomenon, just the objects seen in the sky. And there is that aspect, that facet to the UFO phenomenon. People see the objects, they can tell whether they're flying or hovering or are flying away at tremendous speed or disappearing. There's a tremendous amount of information about the prevalence of UFOs that are not planes and not obviously of terrestrial design around the world. The evidence is not subtle. You don't have to tease it out. It is more like a sledgehammer between the eyes. It's the evidence for UFOs is amazing, actually. It's mind-boggling. But the critical aspect of this is who is inside the UFOs and why is this happening? We used to think way back in the early days that the pilots, in quotes, of the UFOs were just interested in Earth and they were flying around to see what was going on here, and they weren't landing or disrupting anything, so because they didn't want to disrupt the whole civilization like we would do with a tribal society. We come in and ruin it and all that. And so nobody quite understood what the UFO phenomenon was about. In 1957, a case came about in Brazil by an illiterate Brazilian peasant named Antonio Vias Boas. And he claimed that he was taken on board a UFO at night. He was plowing a field at night, and he was taken on board a UFO, and he this happened to him, and that happened to him, this happened to him, and that happened to him, and eventually he was released, and he never forgot it. It was horrible, and it was terrible, and nobody believed that. It was one case does not a pattern make, and absolutely nobody believed that whatsoever. However, the person who investigated was a physician and a very, very intelligent guy. And the case was not even published in UFO literature until 9 years later because there was a sort of sexual aspect to it that it seemed that was extremely embarrassing to the people who looked at that case. Then in 1961, there was the Barney and Betty Hill case. And this was a couple coming back from coming home to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and they said that their car was stopped essentially, and that they were taken on board a UFO. And Barney said that he had sperm taken from him, and there was probably ova taken from Betty, and it was these people were Americans. And they were extremely sensible people. Barney Hill was on the state's NAACP state committee, and he was appointed by President Kennedy to a national committee for civil rights and all that. And Betty was Betty was a social worker and a supervisor and all that. And they were pillars of the community. They said not the same thing, but in the same ballpark of an account as Antonio Vias Boas. Then other people began to come forward with these stories. It wasn't until the 1980s that we learned that Antonio Vias Boas wasn't actually a Brazilian peasant. He was a law student who became an attorney and maintain the truthfulness of what had happened to him for the rest of his life. And then when that happened, we began to realize that the abduction phenomenon was much more widespread, and people were coming forward around, not only around America, but around the world. And then a guy by the name of Bud Hopkins became one of the great pioneer researchers of the abduction phenomenon. And he discovered that people were being abducted all the time, that they were being abducted as children, that they were being abducted as adults, that they had many abductions. I was taught how to do research in this area, which is primarily using hypnosis, but actually it's just straight relaxation techniques. And a person's not in a trance or anything like that. But they tend to remember what happened to them. And I worked in that field just at sort of collecting these accounts from people who would come to me. I never charged any money, and they could come as many times as they wanted. And until I began to see the patterns that were developing here.
So, David, it sounds to me that you're far past if it's happening and what's happening.
No, I'm just telling you what happened to me.
Yeah, well, can you tell me, what do you think, why is this happening?
That comes later. I've got an arc, I'm telling you.
Yeah, no. Okay.
So, where was I now? I began to listen to these reports. All the reports were the same. It was astonishing, right? To the precision of specific instruments. I learned if somebody described an alien bringing over an instrument, I knew what that instrument was for, and I knew what was going to happen, and they didn't. And now I didn't say anything to them, I'm just listening to their narrative, but invariably what I'd already learned happened. And those stories from around the world, I work with people from Latin America, from Asia, from Africa, from obviously from Europe and North America and so forth, and I realized there's never been anything like this in human history. But the question was, why was this happening? Why was all this going on? And I realized as the more I learned about it, that this was a goal-directed program, that these beings were here for a reason, and they were working to do something. They were not just examining us. They weren't trying to figure out what makes us tick or anything like that. They had their own agenda. And it had three aspects to it. It was global. It was intergenerational. If a person is an abductee, their mother or their father or both were abductees beforehand. And when they get married to a non-abductee, because most people are not abductees, their children will all be abductees as well. So it was intergenerational and it was clandestine. That is to say, it was secretive and people did not see other people being abducted because this is a very advanced technology, and people are taken into UFOs right through walls and windows and all the rest of that stuff. And except every once in a while, somebody would witness it and would report back that they saw their neighbor flying through the window and into a UFO. And there are reports like that too, to everybody's astonishment. So the question still is, why? Well, what people were reporting, what women were reporting, is that they were having an embryo implanted in them, and then after about 10 or 12 weeks, the fetus would be taken out. They would then be presented with babies. Bud Hopkins first discovered this, who looked sort of like alien and human. And they would be forced to hold the baby, feed the baby. Lactation had been stimulated in them already. And they would see these children, babies as young children, older children, adolescents, and adults. And there would be certain types of them. Hopkins labeled them hybrids, which was a perfect label, actually. And I was finding, of course, the same thing. And I was working with people who had PhDs and MDs and LLDs, all of whom, if anybody knew that they were saying this to me, would destroy their careers, basically. But they wanted to know so much about what has been happening to them that they were willing to risk it. And what I've discovered over the years is that the goal that is directed, we are unsure of. But in fact, the hybridization program has gotten more and more human-like. And I've just finished a book, published a book called Walking Among Us, because when I was on an interview show, people would say, do you think they're living here yet now? Do you think they're walking among us somewhere, these ones who live like humans? And I would say, absolutely not. There's no evidence whatsoever that they're walking among us. And I felt sane. I could say something that was sane in this insane world in which I was existing now. However, in 2003, after hearing the same accounts over and over and over and over and over again, I began to hear something different. And it was about these beings who appeared to be living here. And one person told me that, and he gave me all this information about it. I put it on the back burner, waiting for anybody else to say the same thing without knowing that he had said it. Then another person said it, and another one, and another one. Then a woman said it who I'd worked with since 1987, said it. And I realized, this is different. I'm hearing something different when for all those years beforehand, I was hearing the same thing over and over again. And as a result of that, I realized that it is well within the realm of probability or possibility that, yes, some of them are living among us. I hate to even say that.
Well, I'm sure you could tell the same thing I could tell from Dr. Jacobs. What started out to be an interesting adventure in his life has turned out to be something quite serious. In fact, something that he doesn't even like to think about too much anymore, because the ramifications of us being actually invaded by an alien species is, at the very least, a very sobering experience to contemplate. Now, if we look at everything going on in the world, I think we have to admit that something is going on beyond human recognition. Something is pulling strings. We can call it the Illuminati, the Cabal, the secret government. We have names for it, but the names are names, and we're still in the dark as to what's really going on. My wife and I, we went to a lecture here the other night in Redding, California. It was Dane Wigington of Geoengineering Watch, which I've interviewed on this show, and Dr. Tenpenny talking about vaccinations, and Kevin Shipp. He's an ex-CIA agent, and he was talking about his experience with the CIA. Now, when you listen to him talk and realize that there's so much that we don't know. There's over 2,000 secret organizations in the United States alone that we don't know about. There's hundreds of thousands of people taking non-disclosure affidavits and under duress if they say anything about what they're doing. They're looking at 10, 15, 20 years in prison. And Dr. Tenpenny, she's talking about the vaccinations and how they do the research. Now, you have to just really get into this and look it up and see that the scientific medical journals will tell you everything you need to know. I've talked to women about the vaccination problem, and they tell me the same thing. There's the herd mentality. There's the science. I get told time and time again, you're not looking at the science. Well, guess what? I have looked at the science recently, and it's telling me something very interesting. How they do this research is completely absurd. For one, I'll just tell you a few things. If they have a research and they're doing research on a mumps vaccine, okay, it has aluminum in it, it has heavy metals and all kinds of toxins, and we all know this. They have their reasons for doing it. Well, their placebo group, unbeknownst to people most everywhere, it seems, they actually put aluminum in the placebo group also. So both groups will have somewhat the same kind of effects. Now, that's not really a placebo group, for one. Another thing is they only take healthy kids. If you have asthma or anything, they don't take you. They only take healthy kids for the research. And during the first week to 10 days, if any of the kids has an adverse reaction to any of the vaccines, they take them out of the program. So now we have healthy kids that have been thinned out. These kids have not had a reaction. And sometimes there's quite a few that's had a reaction, but they're not part of the research at this point. I'm not too sure about you, but this is not how you do a research. And plus the fact that the research should go on for at least a couple of years, and it's usually only a matter of weeks. So I think it's time for us to wake up and pay attention and see what is going on and start questioning some of their answers, because something is not right, and we're going to get to the bottom of it. Okay, now we have a little more time left in today's show, so I'd like to introduce you to Clifford Mahudi. He's a Native American, and he's been into ufology and following this for many, many years, And it's always interesting to hear what the indigenous people, the Native American people, what they have to say, because a lot of ufology seems to happen around them, around Indian reservations. And so I think Clifford has something really important to say from his perspective. So let's listen to Clifford. I ran into him during the my time at the UFO Congress in Arizona. So I was able to catch him and get his take on what's going on. So let's listen to Clifford right now.
Good morning. My name is Clifford Mahudi. I'm a Zuni Pueblo Indian from New Mexico Reservation, the Zuni Indian Reservation. And I'm here at the 20th International UFO Convention in Scottsdale. And it has been quite an experience for me to have finally worked with a group that combines all the different aspects of ufology, star people concepts, paranormal activities, history that deals with UFOs, not only the technical side, but also the spiritual side. It used to be that a lot of the UFO people were talking about that they come from outer space back in the 1950s into the 60s. There's a lot of things that were happening, especially in the movies, that talk about the invasion from people from other planets. Prior to that, of course, as everybody knows about the Roswell incident back in 1947. So it's a combination of things that require the getting together of different groups of people, different backgrounds, whether they were scientists, military. And for a long time, they were sort of like the exclusive group of in the military sector, which was held probably in a secret type of way. Recent times, they're finally including the American Indian, the original people of this continent and other continents, like down in South America, Mexico, our brothers to the north. And they've always had history of UFOs. Even in the European countries, the Middle Eastern countries, there's also records of it, some of which were in the Bible. A lot of writings from different groups, Chinese, other groups that have written about this, whether by story, whether by incorporation in their concepts. But the American Indian has always had that direct connection, because those are the ones that gave the American Indian and indigenous tribes the way to take care of each other, the planet, and all living things that are on the planet, whether they be animal life, whether they be plant life, or other lives that we cannot normally see, which is what we call the spirit world. So there has been a lot of misunderstanding in the past about things that are on record. For example, one of the latest findings are the petroglyphs all over the world, but primarily out here in the Southwest. There were Indian tribes, indigenous Indian tribes, that had to put their records on something permanent. And in this case, they put it on the rock walls, protected away from the elements, the rain, the windstorms. And so you go out here in the Southwest, in any given direction from here, you can find petroglyphs. Some of them are still out there that has never been seen by other people. Some of them has been out there for many centuries. Nobody knows how many centuries. And one of the things that I've learned recently is that there are also petroglyphs of the Orientals that are side by side with the original inhabitants of the Indian ancestry. And so when we have meetings like this one here, we go through a lot of these different subjects, and we're still trying to figure out how things happen to become, especially the connection between the star people concepts, the phenomenon of how do flying saucers come from different parts of the universe, different star systems within our solar system, and also the connection that has been made by other groups of other places, like, for example, the Arcturian people, the Pleiadian people, Syrians. And so there's a whole bunch of them. And within recent times, there have been a lot of people that claim to be direct descendants of those type of people from outer space. However, in the case of the American Indian, I have yet to hear of any group that says that we came from this planet, we came from Mars, we came from a planet out there in a different star system. The common theme of the American Indian community is that we were given the instructions, we were given the protocols by the star. We were created on this earth. We were not brought in from any other star system, any other planet. We were always here in a very primitive form, but through their efforts, we became what we are. Sort of like in the concept of the Anunnaki, where they had an interbreeding hybrid system or engineering of sort to make advanced man. And the archetype in Indians of the Southwest especially has been that the star people or whoever they were the one that improved the human, or what later became a human being in many different ways, whether it was by including splicing of other gene systems, advancing ideas or incorporating methodologies, or at least some type of a way to make a functional human being. But it has always been that the American Indian has always had a spiritual aspect of it, not only within themselves, but also with other living things. The American Indian believes that, and other Aborigines believe that everything has life. Whether it be a plant life, whether it be animal life, or things that a lot of people don't consider, like the trees and the rocks and different things that make up the earth.
So do you think we're getting ready for an overt entry into our reality from some extraterrestrial races?
I believe that this has happened in the past. So right now we're, if you look at some of the teachings of the Hopi, the Zuni, the Southwest Indian tribes, which I'm pretty well familiar with, is that we have always had a time schedule. And the time schedule had other elements that with it. If this happens, then this will happen. It's a deductive reason with physical things that will occur not only within the or on the planet and within the planet, but other things that are of what we call the upper world people. So if you look at, for example, the Hopi the Zuni and all that. We consider this as the fourth world. The other three worlds were destroyed in the past. So we all believe that this is toward the end of this present earth as we know it.
Which is the beginning of the fifth world.
Which would become the fifth world. I think there was a lot of misinterpretations, for example, when we had that the Mayan calendar,
yeah,
it's the end of the world type situation. It's more complex than that, but I believe that this was a lot of misinformation, which is now been, especially with the internet right now. It used to be that, well, it's got to be true because it was in National Enquirer. Now the attitude is that it's got to be true because it's on the internet.
Yeah.
And if you look at all the websites, you have to kind of work your way through that, and you have to have somebody with a resource and the common sense to say that a lot of things is not going to happen.
Yeah, you need a lot of discernment when you're researching or doing any kind of investigative,
yes,
work, you know.
So, mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Okay, you know what? I think we have time for one more little. It's the tail end of an interview I did with Drun Vallo recently. And if you don't know who Drun Vallo Melchizedek is, you should look him up also. Sacred geometry is his field, his passion, but he also is a walk-in, and he's had a lot to say over the years. I started listening to his videotapes, the VHS tapes, so that's a long time ago, about around 1997, and his workshop on sacred geometry. Since then, my wife and I have taken his workshops and been following him, and I've done several interviews with him. Really nice guy, and he's out there to change the world in some amazing ways. He's had some amazing experiences. I mean, experiences you can't even believe. But he touches on something in this interview. It's only like about 2 or 3 minutes. It's the tail end of a long interview we did, which I'll play some other time. But he touches on something that I also touched on with David Serrada. We have a mutual connection with Trevor Constable. Trevor Constable wrote a book back in the late 50s, something like They Live in the Sky, or They Live and Breathe in the Sky or something. But it was a book that sort of changed my life. I was 8 years old when I read it. And to read a book that was telling me that there's living beings in our upper atmosphere that we can't see without the help of some special photography, it opened my eyes. Then about a year and a half later, I was on a train coming out to California from Ohio, and I had a UFO experience. It was 2, 3, 4 in the morning. We were somewhere out in the desert, Arizona, New Mexico. And like I say, I was 9, 9 and a half years old. I got up to go get a drink of water. They had those crazy little cone cups that crumples in your hands if you're not careful. And I'm walking back to my seat with my little glass of water. And I noticed the train, inside the train, was glowing red. And as I sat on my seat, it was an optical illusion almost, because I looked outside and it looked like we were standing still because the UFO was 50 feet away from the train. It was a long cylindrical object and followed us for about a minute and a half, then went over on the other side of the train and stayed for maybe another minute, and then just took off. And the next morning, I heard people talking about what they saw. You know, what was that? And the funny thing is I didn't tell anybody that I seen anything until I was about 13 years old. And I find that strange. It seems like I would have told everybody, but I kept it to myself. And when I was talking to David Serrada, he came up about Trevor Constable. And now Trevor Constable has a book out called, let me see what it's called. It's called Cosmic Pulse of Life. And it's about the fact that there are living, breathing beings, orbs, up in the upper atmosphere. And if you look up Trevor Constable and then plug in Tether and NASA. It'll pull up some of the films that NASA took that cannot be explained. So I'm hoping that you'll enjoy Drumvalo. He's always a character to talk to. He always gives me something to think about. He always tells me something that I don't believe, but later on I come to find out it's true. So I've learned to listen to him over the years. So let's listen to Drumvalo Melchizedek.
Really appreciate your time, Drumvalo.
Well, I appreciate you. I see you're really trying to help people. And when I see that kind of sincerity and honesty, I want to do everything I can to help you.
Yeah, we've become a pivotal center up here in Northern California with the magazine. And it's a interesting position to be in. You know, our last issue was, this one. Are We Alone? You know? And I, during the research for that, I just seen so much information out there that we're not only not alone, we've never been alone.
Well, not only that, we used to have a device that we had that could see, is a sensing device, ran through computers. And one time we left it sitting there and we're not moving. I started looking in there and you can act, there's life forms moving through all the time. We could see them. And it's like, nobody is ever alone. And I mean, seriously, really.
Right.
You're in your bedroom, you think nobody's here. Well, yeah, right. There's like probably about 35 other people in that room.
Yeah.
This is where it leads to is that what we now know is that on higher levels of consciousness, in fact, the very next one up, there, and from there on in, there are no secrets in the universe.
Yeah.
You can't hide anything or deceive anything or anything. It's not possible.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting way to live. You know, just one more thing. I was walking down the street a few months back and this lady come up to me and says, oh, you published the Lotus Guide. Yeah, and my name's Rahasia. She says, all the things that you print in that magazine are pretty amazing. She says, I'm just curious, what do you think the most amazing thing about life is? And I'm standing there thinking, God, there's all kinds of amazing things. And it dawned on me. I said, you know what? The most amazing thing to me is that there's people walking around on the planet that don't think it's amazing at all.
Yeah.
I don't know how they do that. How do they get up every morning and not be just amazed at their own existence? I mean, look at this. We exist. And
I know.
Yeah, just,
and we exist at a lot of other levels at the same time. So anyway, I just really thank you for you doing it. And if you ever need another one or want another interview in the future sometime, just let me know.
All right, Jim. Well, thank you very much, and you have a good day.
You too.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, we're concluding another show on the Spiritual Activist Channel. And remember, this channel is totally supported by community support. You can visit www.spiritualactivist.com to make a donation, and it's a tax-deductible donation. And you can also read our magazine at www.lotusguide.com. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next show.